Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. This is part two of my episode with Peter Purich, who is an inspiring and creative violin maker known for his unique personalized chinrest design. He's also a multi-instrumentalist who performs in many different styles and a dedicated violin and viola pedagogue. Because this conversation was extra long, it has been divided into two episodes. If you missed part one, it delved into his development as a luthier and as a creative musician. He showed and described some of his innovations with chinrest design, and you got to hear him playing some improvisations and also some fantastic parenting advice. Part two will now continue with a lot of specifics about playing and teaching the violin, some of his innovative instrument designs, his unique shoulder support, and some great wisdom. I've added timestamps in the description, and like all these episodes, this is available both as a podcast and a video. The link is in the description, and the transcript will be published to the same link.
So I have a few bugaboos, you know.
Tell me about those bugaboos. I'm really curious.
Okay, so, let's see, a couple of them. The weight, mm-hmm. Okay? I hear teachers all over the place talking about using the weight of the arm, you know?
Yeah.
And, that doesn't make any sense. You know, when you start to think about it, what is weight? When we talk about our own weight, you know, you weigh yourself on a scale. It's the force of gravity which is pulling you down, okay? So weight is, by definition, a force. And, like, yeah, we do use certain words in physics and certain words in science, such as theory. You know, let's say it's a theory in science. It's not the same meaning as a theory in colloquial terminology. You know, I got a theory which is more like a hypothesis, you know, but in science, a theory is a different thing from what we usually say. So when we say weight, you know, people think of weight as something that's sort of heavy-ish, maybe, you know. But weight is actually a force by definition. So I ask myself, you know, what weight am I using? And like, use the weight how? The force of gravity down this? I can't, because I'm actually have to hold everything up, mm-hmm. You know. So I'm using force to hold stuff, because if I let, the violin's going to drop down unless I hold it up. And the forces are balanced because it's not moving anywhere. So the force of gravity goes down. I do the equal opposite force, and it maintains equilibrium. My arm is here. If I use any weight to go down, it's going to go down. But it's transferred to the bow. How? What is this? What does this mean? You know, so these, if I go up to the space station, can I not play the violin because I don't have weight? It's weightless up there. You know, and which direction is this force going? You know, and so none of these questions made sense in the terms of weight. Yet, teachers talk about weight all the time. Use the weight, you know, and they get some results, okay? And so this comes back to my form of pedagogy. I have two sort of schools of approach, what I call the front door, the back door. Mm-hmm. So the front door is I tell somebody, this is your bow, this is the angle, 45 degrees, go, you know? And if it doesn't work, you know, if I keep trying, explaining technically exactly what's happening, and I'm not getting a result, I go to the back door, which is through imagery. Mm-hmm. I say, okay. I say, think of a life puffy cloud, and you're on this cloud, and you're floating, and your bow's there, and your violin's not, and that gentle wind comes up, and now you play. You know, let's say that's sort of imagery. It has nothing to do with violin playing, it's just imagery. And they play, and it sounds great. I said, great, let's go. That's it, you've done it, you know. They don't know what they did, you know. It didn't matter. The image, whatever they did. The reason it works is because our brain is very complicated, okay? And our brain, we have two sides, left and right side. Left side is more like the analytical, the factual part. And the right side is more involved with generalizations, let's say. Again, that's a generalization of the brain function, because it's the brain works in both sides all the time. But you can approach the same problem, right or left side of the brain, and depending on how you get at it, you could get the result that you're looking for. So the problem is that if I give somebody a technical description of what's happening, and it's not actually accurate, if they rely on that, they will fail. You know, if I give them an image, they may succeed. You know, because their interpretation of the image, again, might not be the same as my image, you know, and I might be just throwing images at them. Okay, forget about the clouds. You're in a pool of water, Okay, you're weightless, da-da-da-da-da-da. Okay, now that works. Now you get that. So images can work through the fuzzy part of the brain, and then we do all sorts of stuff, because to play the violin is very complex. You know, it's simple physically, but what we have to actually do to accomplish the sounds, the blowings, there's a lot of things going on which our left side of the brain cannot keep up with, but the right side can, you see? So I like to work with both sides of the brain, you know, and train them how to work together, you know? So when I talk about weight, I was thinking, well, what is happening, you know? And then I discovered that, well, through all my work with people, getting them to be relaxed and stuff like that, and the way the bow has to go, you know, perpendicular, and what are we doing with our positioning? Because when somebody comes to me, I align them. I take their measurements, top and bottom, how wide, how long their arms are and stuff like that. And we set the right angles so they can be efficient and play. But then sometimes, you know, even though I set them up with the right angles and stuff like that, it's not going to work. I had one client who said, you know what? It doesn't matter what chin rest I give you. Doesn't matter what size of this and that. You're going to play in this tense fashion and you're going to be in pain. So you got to come to me for lessons on how to play differently. Okay, we got to change the way you actually approach the whole thing. So a lot of that has to do with the usage of the muscles and the impressions that we have of our muscles, and you got to at some point maybe isolate them. So you have muscles to hold up your arm, you know, so it doesn't drop down. You have to hold the bow, boom. So your arm is being, so this is the muscles that hold up the arm, but they shouldn't interfere with the ones to use to actually do the bowing, you see. But how do you isolate them, you know, and how do you maybe discover which ones you actually need? So I've got a few devices. I got like a loop thing suspended on like bungee cords, which will help people understand that this is the muscles that only hold up your arm. So we're going to shut them off by having something else hold up your arm. Okay, now this is, and so these are the ones that go back and forth. Now what is the direction that you're going to have to bow? And you're going to have to bow perpendicular to the string. I'm sorry, you can do it otherwise, but if you want to produce what we call a nice sound on the violin, you have to produce a Helmholtz resonance, and that is moving some object perpendicular to the string. That's just the way it happens. If any other angle, you're going to be setting up an interference, and your sound quality is not going to be good. I'm doing these air quotes here, okay? Because sounds, using words like good and bad sound on a violin, I don't use those words. It's like desirable. What are you actually trying to produce? Because sometimes you want to produce a crunchy sound. That is a sound that you have to produce. But how do you do that? You don't call it a bad sound. You just say it's a crunchy sound. So good and bad are terms one should never use. So that's why I use these air quotes. But just telling somebody to please make a nice sound, you know, what does that mean? You know, it doesn't help me at all. So one of my inventions here is what I call my bowing machine. Okay, so here it's a violin shaped piece of wood type of thing with a sort of a solid wooden bridge with a adjustable setting here and a little hole through which I stick an arrow, you know, which is my bow. So when you look at it this way, okay, so basically the idea is that you have to bow perpendicular to this to this violin form. But this stick here is that hole that it goes through is has a little mechanism which I made inside that if you deviate by a couple of degrees, this is adjustable by the way, so you can make it really fine-tuned. If you deviate from the it locks. Okay? So the only way to bow, if you start to pull to one side, is clearly only perpendicular. And there was no friction if you go exactly straight. Okay, but once you start to deviate, it'll lock. So this is a very clear method to show people that they're not bowing straight, you know. Now, if you don't bow straight, you can still make a sound, you know. But if you want to make a nice sound, you know, clean Helmholtz resonance is what I like to call it, you know, then you have to go perpendicular. So you're doing that, so you have to teach your arm, you know, to bow from the side. And that's very complex, because at every millimeter, the angles in your bone structure have to change, okay. And then your fingers and everything like that has to change minutely the entire bow stroke. And they don't do it in a linear fashion either. For instance, at some point your knuckles are moving far more than your upper arm. But at some point at the end, your upper arm is moving because you're approaching the frog. But then when you're around the middle of the bow, your upper arm and elbow doesn't move at all. So your whole different parts of your arm are moving at different speeds all the time. Very complicated, you know. And how do you do that? Well, you have to get your right side of your brain in it, you know, into this action, because to do all these subtle actions that are needed in my thing, your analytical part of your brain cannot handle that. Okay, so I have a series of exercises, you know, that I get people. So you got the Boeing machine, series of exercises to get your, you start off with your left side of your brain to learn where the positions are for your arm, and then the transition is taken over by the mm-hmm. right side of the brain, you know. So it's switching back and forth from the different sides of the brain. One of my hobbies is archery. And I remember years ago there was a music camp in Israel that did a lot of archery, and they thought it helped their violin playing. I tried to find how it did that and like what their methodology was, but in all the articles I read at the time, there was no explanation as what they thought was the positive attributes of archery. But anyway, I discovered some myself. You know, three things that I can apply from my archery work to my violin playing. So one of them is the meditative aspect, you know, like Zen meditation. I tried to do meditation years ago, but I have trouble sitting still like that in a sense. But I found that meditation through action, especially something focused like archery, was very beneficial. So that's one thing, to learn to clear out the noise in your brain and be focused. Is exactly what I needed sometimes in my violin playing as well, you know. So in archery, you have to do it, because if you're not in the zone, if your head's not clear, your arrow just goes somewhere else rather than where you'd want it to be. And the other thing I learned was the difference between left brain and right brain action. So in archery, the idea is you have to set yourself up. Pull the arrow back towards your head and maintain a specific position, okay? And then you have to release. And the position that you're in will determine the angle the arrow takes off, left or right, high or low. And so that's very important, that you be very consistent every time. And this is very much a combination of left and right brain, but you do a lot of analytical thinking. Okay, I'm going to move my shoulder blades in and stuff like that, get my position right. And then comes the moment of truth, the release. The release is extremely important, because if you don't do it cleanly, you know, you can affect just a half a millimeter off here can mean 2 feet off at the target end. But the thing is, it happens very quickly, very quickly. So the way you release has to be unconscious, you know. They did brain studies on archers, and they realized that the activity on the left side, conscious side of the brain, was very busy while they're setting up. But at the very moment of release, it's like the left side of the brain shut down and was not involved, and only the right side intuitive, so-called intuitive side, boom, is what you needed. And if you had the other side, then you're going to get too much. It's like paralysis from analysis type of thing. You know, it's not going to work. So you have to realize at which point you want to let go. You know, so that taught me a lot, you know, about one thing, how to practice intonation accuracy. And the other thing was that it taught me that you can isolate different muscular things, because when you're holding 40 pounds here, it's very tight, but you can't be tight all over. You have to be loose at some point, you know. So the combination of using and not using certain muscles. When you bow, my big mantra is less is more. So the less muscles, the fewer muscles you use, the better off you're going to be. Just you have to know which ones to use.
And I just wanted to ask you about this whole arm weight thing, because I also teach this, right? I have a video about arm weight, because I was taught that by Fuchs and it makes sense to me. But I do think of it as more imagery, Peter. So it's not like, of course, we have to hold up our upper arm, but it prevents people from squeezing and pressing down. And there's like what I talk about is like degrees of weight in terms of how much you're sinking into the string in the most relaxed way. But it's not.
Okay. So I'm just getting to that. Just getting to that. So what you said is exactly what I was taught, you know, which made no sense to me. Okay. Because I could also say, well, if it is gravity, and okay, I can understand sort of this, but as I move to the E string, you know, gravity is going down and the E string is sideways. But what happens, what I discovered was that when you isolate the muscles, okay, and then I started doing that, realizing that, okay, in order for it to do all these things that needed to be done and the proper thing, okay, if we reduce the muscles to only the ones that we want, you suddenly realize that, yeah, the muscles around your fingers really don't have to do that much except just hold the grip, okay? If the concentration of focus is on the fingers, you know, you will not be able to do those small actions that you really need to do, okay? And then they won't change as they need to, and then you'll get basically a rigidity, let's say call it a static, and you won't get a clean bow stroke. So if these muscles and tendons in your hand can be as loose as possible, and you can use the larger muscles, okay, then you'll get a much fuller sound, okay? And using my support system, you know, it was much clearer that that this is what's happening. And oddly enough, now that you mentioned, I was at National Youth Orchestra with Mauricio Fuchs and with Rodney Friend, and I discovered this elbow hanging thing. This was while I was still taking lessons with Fuchs. And so I had taken a towel, wrapped it around my elbow and with a rope and hung it up on the hook on the door, you know, and I was testing my theory out, you know, and I said, wow, it sounds so different. I don't know. Is this true? So I went to see Fuchs, you know, and Rodney Friend was in there. So I said, listen, guys, here, turn around. I'm going to play you two things, okay? So I played something as best as I could, passage, and then I hooked up my elbow to the door there, and I played the exact same thing, you know, and then said, okay, what do you think? And they said, well, the second one was just way better sound, you know? Both of them agreed right there. So, boom, you know, I said, I'm onto something, you know? This is the weight. It's not weight. What it is using the right muscles and relaxing the ones that you mm-hmm. that you shouldn't have tense, okay? So it's more about, you know, using, being loose, yes, you know, but it's not about weight.
Yeah.
It's all about looseness. It's all about not using the finger ones. And so if you can teach that somehow, you know, then, you know, the end result will be the same. Now, if some people say use the weight and you get it sound, that's fine, you know, but to me, it just never made sense because I was thinking logically. It doesn't mm-hmm. make sense. I can't use any weight. I have to take weight off. In fact, most of the time when you're playing the violin, you have to be removing weight. The bow itself is 65 grams approximately. You know, anywhere lower in the frog, you have to be taking weight off unless you're playing, yeah. you know, forte, you know, and we're not doing that, you know. So it just, you know, you have to learn how to take weight off, okay? And that was the whole idea. And then for me, it's using the right muscles, using them in the right direction, okay? So and that was the other bugaboo. You know, was out, in, out, in, you know. So why? You know, why am I going out and in, you know? And everybody's talking about that out and in, you know, and big names talking out and in. And I couldn't find the source for this, you know. I don't know, do you know? Do you know the source for the out and the in?
I believe wrote about that in his book, but I might be wrong.
Well, yeah. You know, I thought so too, you know. And I kept hearing that Galamian was the one who did it. So I...
Yeah, I have it right there.
Got his book.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I read the book carefully. And there is one mention, and I think it's an error of the out and the in. But all the other things specify mm-hmm. a straight bow with no exception. There is actually one exception, but it's not an out and in. You know, and I think people have misconstrued mm-hmm. what he actually wrote, because maybe he taught differently in class, but in his book, which he took 10 years to write, mm-hmm. he does not say that. He does not say that. I could get the book and read you the quotes if you want, but we don't have time now, I don't think.
No, that's fine.
Unless you want.
No, it's just funny. A recent guest, I spoke with Tracy Silverman. He studied with Mr. Galamian, so I was asking him about lessons with him, and it sounds like
okay.
he didn't say very much at all in lessons. It's very...
Yeah. I saw some videos, you know, like they're kind of boring, you know, like, you know, yes, again, once again, okay, five notes. Bum, yeah. I was like, it must have been different, you know, but the book is very... I got to say, I read the book, you know, many years ago, and... again, recently, and I was looking for specific things, and with my pedagogy that I've designed myself, I agree with a lot of things he wrote, pretty much everything. And you know, I just might mm-hmm. say something a little differently than he says. But, and, you know, his, I got to say, the book is the fundamentals. He doesn't go into a lot of higher level details. Like sometimes he would say something and I'd say, yeah, it's right. You know, and then I think, yeah, and he probably knows about the rest of it, but he just didn't write it in, you know. So, but he's quite clear on the bow. And as far as I'm concerned, he and I agree that there is no out and in. You know, there is a, what he talks about, and you can read your book, okay? I'll just tell you where it is, okay? There's two paragraphs. So what he's talking about, and he says, and look at the highlights, it's right there, extremely straight bow. You must have a straight bow. And he says the bow must be straight in all bowing conditions, you know? And he writes in italics. He's really big on that straight bow. And so I say, yes, yes, because that's, for me, that's number one, Helmholtz. And then he says, in order for you to produce a straight bow, okay, when you're in the middle, you're good. But as you produce, as you go towards the point, okay, this is where the mistake in the book is, and the editors did not catch this, okay? And I think it's a mistake because in the following paragraph, he says something totally different. So in this first paragraph, he says, so drawing the straight bow, I have mm-hmm. I have all these annotations here and stuff. This actually, this copy of my book is just, not to get too verbose here, is doubly annotated. The first annotation, I picked this up in a secondhand bookstore, and there's a dedication here. It's 1963. It says, pour ma soeur Marie-Thérèse Eugène, en remerciement de son grand Calvin Sieb. Yeah, Calvin Sieb gave this book to, I think, his teacher, mm-hmm. who was a nun, I suppose, or something like that. So, and he dedicated to it. So I found it in a secondhand bookstore. Anyway, getting back to, so drawing the bow straight, okay? Page 51. Okay. Straight bow. The straight bow stroke from frog to tip is the foundation of the entire bowing technique. That's what he says. I'm getting into my reading glasses here. Okay, so that's, like me, rule number one, okay? Unless there's exceptions. But always maintain that. Okay, three stages. Okay. Now, page 52 here, okay, the square, remember we talked about the square to the point. To draw the bow successfully from the square to the point, as the bow hand moves outward to the right, okay? Now, that's not really a misquote, but when he says outward, I think he's meaning out to the side. Okay, it doesn't mean out from the body, because as the bow hand moves outward to the right, it must also push very gradually forward in approaching the tip of the stick in order to preserve the bow's parallel relationship with the bridge. So what he's saying is you have to do something to make sure that the bow stays parallel, perpendicular to the strings, to the bridge. So, but the mistake here is, says the bow hand, and then this outward to the right, it must also push very gradually forward. It's not the bow hand that pushes. Okay, it's the upper arm. Okay, so then this motion is performed by stretching the forearm and pushing forward the upper arm. Mm. Pushing forward the upper arm. Okay, so the reason underlying the necessary forward motion rests in the circular character of the natural movements of the arm. He talks about circles, which I find a sort of unnecessarily confusing, because they are sort of circular motions, but it's a very, it's like too technical thing for what we really need to. I prefer to talk in linear motions rather than circular. But anyway, that's where he and I maybe just disagree in the presentation. Mm-hmm. But if you understand what he's getting at, it's, we're talking about the same thing. As the point of the bow is approached, unless the upper arm purposely pushes forward, the lower arm will naturally describe a backward moving arc as it opens up down the down bow. So what he's saying is that as you're bowing, if you don't move your upper arm forward, your elbow forward, if you just keep moving the lower arm, you're going to be describing an arc and your bow is going to go crooked. Because the rule number one is the bow must go straight. Okay, so there is no out. There's just straight. But what you have to do to produce a straight is to move your elbow forward. Okay. The bow hand has to reach gradually forward, frontward, as the arm straightens. For the sake of brevity, we have called this forward motion on the down bow the out motion. It's not the hand that goes out, it's the upper arm, it's the elbow that goes out. in order to keep the bow. Thus, from the square to the point, the bow moves out on the down bow. And then he proceeds, the next paragraph says, when you're returning up bow from the point to the square, the movements are reversed. So then he says, the elbow gradually bends. So you're out here. Okay, let's get the camera. You're out here. And it says, elbow gradually bends, bringing the forearm from its straight line position back to its right angle relationship as the middle of the bow is approached. The upper arm begins to pull backwards as the up bow stroke starts. So from your up at the point, as you start to go up, the upper arm has to move back. This is simple mechanics. Yeah. If you can make a robotic arm, this is what it would do, okay? And he says the upper arm begins to pull backwards, the up bow. This backward motion we shall term the in motion. The hand and arm return to the square position. So there's no out in of the bow. The bow is straight. He never said that. He never said that. Later on, he talks about an interesting situation, which is what would be called an exception, which he notifies. And that is that you should have a slight angle, let's say if you're doing an up bow, bring the bow closer to the bridge, the sounding point, closer to the bridge. You just extremely small angular change, bring it in. But he says this is the same angle for up and down, you see, which is a little bit interesting, let's say. It's a slight deviation, but it's not on every bow stroke you're going to be going like figure eights or something like that. There was another chap from England who's I've seen some YouTubes who talks about not so much an out and in, but it's more like a semicircular stroke towards the bridge. And he has written a book on pedagogy, describes this, and I, of course, as you've surmised, I'm not in agreement with any deviations. Plus, it causes you to put your arm too far out. I mean, it's hard enough anyway. As Galamian says, a lot of people will get to the tip and they're not actually at the tip of the bow. You know, these people should get a shorter bow, especially young kids. Get them a shorter bow or something like that. So to push out at the tip is like, it's worse for your shoulder. You should never have to push your shoulder forward. So, and then he advocates this sort of movement. And I say, okay. So I look on YouTube to see how he plays. And I find one video. There weren't very many. I find one video which shows a nice visual angle. And he is bang on straight. He does no thing. So he doesn't play like he teaches. He plays really nicely. But it's straight, So I don't see the purpose if the purpose is, and I understand sometimes, if you don't, if the tendency is to go back, well, you overcompensate, you go forward, and maybe you'll be in the middle. And I prefer to say, look, just go straight, and if your muscles are getting tight at the tip, don't go to the tip, just stay where you are, and that sort of thing. Now, I do have exceptions, to when, if you are approaching the tip, and you get to the tip and you're not there yet and you still have to play, you can pull back, but then you have to straighten out your arm again. Once you're back on track, then you do a straight bow. But it's not an out and in. When you're at the frog, don't go out. Your sound's going to get too articulated, unless you want it to be articulated. There again, if you want to produce that bad sound, then go out at the frog. Bad sound would be what? Well, to me, I'd rather say articulated sound. So you get that crunch, you get that consonance. Every note that we make has an attack, which is the consonance. It has a sustain and a decay. Just the same thing as when you hit a piano note. There's attack, sustain, decay. So on a violin, we can do the same thing. So it's the attack which describes the quality of the sound to a very great degree. If you could make a recording and slice off the attack and just hear sustain on a violin, you might not even know that it's a violin. You might think it's a trumpet or an oboe, because the attacks are so identifiable to the characteristic of an instrument that if you don't hear that, even when you're trying different instruments, like when I play different instruments, the attack is what tells me what the instrument is like. The sustain, almost one violin sounds just like the other, but it's the attacks, the just that change from silence to noise and grab and release. That is where they characterize in that little microsecond, okay? So that's what's very important.
So your violin you play on most of the time, is it ones you've made?
Yeah, it's the only ones I can afford, yeah. That was my thing. Yeah, I always played my own. I played my dad's violins all the time since I was 12, and because they were good. And then I made mine, and I thought, well, I might as well play mine. And my very first one, I was subbing in the Montreal Symphony, and it was fine. And people played and said, yeah, it's good, you know. Then I made, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5. And so, yeah, they're good. I like them. And
can you show us?
Then I, yeah, sure. But what I can show you, well, I showed you this is, this mm-hmm. what I had was playing over here. This is kind of interesting because, okay, let me just back up a bit. Why I do what I do. So I make custom-made instrument chin rests, but at the same time I'm thinking, well, not everybody is comfortable with their instruments. So I was sitting in the Metropolitan Orchestra for a few years with my viola, and I said, this is kind of heavy. It's hard to play. Must be a better way, because that's all I do. I just keep thinking of better ways to do stuff. And I said, so I was sitting there and thinking, I should change that. I can change that. I can change that. So I had a whole new design for a viola come out. I wanted it to be ergonomic. I wanted the response to be different and stuff like that. So I came up with a new design of viola.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So there were, this is actually my second model. My first model was very good. And I sold it to the wife of David Zinman in Baltimore. And it had a few more modifications than this one, but this was the essential design. So first thing you see is the slope shoulders, okay? So the reason for that is so that you can get in the higher positions a lot better. It's not a brilliant invention. Auto Air Edition Toronto was making cutaways, you know, and he wasn't the first one. We just cut away the corner of the instrument so your hand can reach up. That was, a lot of people didn't like it because it had a bit of an amputated look to it, you know. So I opted to go for a more symmetrical. But at the same time, the amputated look was basically the regular instrument with a cutaway. What I did was I took the neck, instead of just sticking it on the end of an instrument, I recessed it back into the end block, into the neck block. So they occupy the same space. So that was an innovation. What that does is it brings your arm a little bit closer, okay. So that is the problem, that the arm... Okay, this is what this discomfort is for violists and small violinists, is the arm. The more the arm is stretched out, it feels heavier because it is, your arm's out there. But the critical problem is the angle between the upper body and the torso. It's this angle here, okay? If this angle gets too big, okay, it's going to pull your shoulder blade out like that. And that's what really hurts. So the whole point is to bring this angle down. So when you're playing a violin, it's much lower, okay, type of thing. And so the whole point was to bring things in. So that was one of the issues. I was doing some acoustic tests. I decided to make the sound holes going out to the side rather than, I wanted to increase a different vibrating area here and there. So this was my first thought, but it was very successful. It worked nicely. And so this would be, let's say, a medium-sized viola. Then I made a much larger viola. I decided to this would be like 18 inches to here or something like that, but because of the slope shoulder design, it's still very easy to play, you know, that sort of thing. And then I thought, you know what the problem is for kids, so I made what would be, let's say, a three-quarter violin with the same design. The whole point of this is to make a smaller instrument but which has the acoustical properties of a full-size instrument. Okay, so this is part of the innovation here, is we make instruments which are smaller for smaller people. You know, if you take, I did a whole measurement thing. People who are like 5'6", this, like, so I'm average 5'8", 8 3/4, something like that. I'm average size, so slightly less than me is 5'6". I don't know how tall you are. You're 5'6" or something like that, maybe.
Yeah.
You're 5'3". You're on this. Yeah. So you're below the 5. And go up to 6 feet, which is a reasonably tall person. But, you know, they can be 6'1", 6'2". You know, I had one client with 6'7". You know, I said, please, take up the viola. You know, so your wing wasted on the violin is like this. So if you take and assume that the standard 4/4 size violin is okay for the 5'6" to 6-foot person, okay? Well, the 6-foot person has an advantage over the 5'6". Person. Okay, but what is that advantage? You know, I did some measurements in proportional percentage. It's hard to be exact on this, and it's because everybody's different, built differently. But the point is that if I took the same sort of feeling for a 5'6" person to a 6-foot person, and I said, okay, now I'm going to reduce the size of the violin, okay, to make it comfortable for you, the same way, let's say for a shorter person, okay, you should actually be playing like a quarter size violin, okay? So, and if I take a, you know, you understand what I'm saying, the way it works out from that little middle section is that anybody lower than 5'6" down to 5 feet, and I had clients at 5 foot, you know, and they're playing violins, and that's like a 6-foot person playing a humongous viola, okay? Not a regular viola, it's playing a humongous viola. Okay, so you can imagine the
difficulties. But people's hand sizes and arm lengths aren't necessarily correlated to their height.
If you take a person mm-hmm. and measure them from their height, and then measure them fingertip to fingertip, most people are square. Yeah, so if you're 5'3", mm-hmm. measure your fingertip to fingertip, you're probably 5'3". I measure all my clients the first thing when they come in. And if they're mm-hmm. square, they're average. Some people are mm-hmm. slightly longer in their arm, and they say, okay, I'm not going to treat you as a 5'3 person because you're obviously 5'5", you know, for my purposes, which is like where I'm going to put the mm-hmm. bow in this thing. But some people come in and they're 5'6", and I measure them and they're actually only 5'4". I said, okay, we got a problem. Your arms aren't as long as you are tall, okay? So I have to work out a position because I want the bow to mm-hmm. be perpendicular. Also, I want it to be efficient, okay? If they're going to be doing their detaché in the lower part of the bow all the time, that is no good. The bow is not built for that. The bow has a sort of ideal place where you want to do detaché. It's like middle and a bit into the upper area, you know? So if you have somebody who's very tall, okay, and they're playing stuff that's, you know, if you just take somebody with string crossings, okay, somebody who's tall, they're playing over here, okay? Somebody who's short, they're playing over here. Okay, it's totally different because as the bow does this, okay, you have all this upper part of the bow, which is mass, which is, has to swing back and forth, okay? And every time it does that, every time you change strings, this part doesn't want to move. It's a law of inertia, right? And when you do move it, it's a force, okay? And the force results in pressure, okay? And that's an extra consonant. So if you want to play with bite, you play down here, okay? If you want to play smooth, you play up here, okay? If you have to change strings like this very fast but cleanly, what do you do? Well, if you're a long arm person, you're going to be playing up here. Take somebody like James Ennis. You watch him play his Bach. All the detaché stuff is up here, nice and clean, because he doesn't have the rest of the bow to bring, give him his consonants, right? But a short person can't afford that. So what do you do with them? You give them a shorter bow, or you give them a position where maybe they'll be able to be perpendicular, okay? So if you're here, and if you got short arms, that's as far as you're going to get. But if we move the instrument here and on your shoulder, suddenly you're perpendicular here. So these are all considerations to be taken when you set somebody up. So that now if somebody comes like this and they're short arm, they say, no, we're going to have to move you over on your shoulder, okay? Can we do that? Is the rotation of your arm going to allow this? Are your fingers long enough to handle the G string mm-hmm. now that I've moved you over? Because like this, it's a lot easier to get to the G string. But once I start to move you over, okay? So finding the correct position is a matter of all these parameters and compromise, okay? If somebody comes to the fourth with a short fingers, I can't move them over that much. They're not going to be able to play. Or maybe we're going to tilt the instrument. That's going to make it a little easier, you know? But do they play with the shoulder rest or not? You know, these are all things to consider. It's not just, there's no one size fits all, you know? So I have to look at the whole situation.
Are you playing with a shoulder support? Because you said you had developed something.
Yeah. So over the years, I've played with a lot of different things. I eventually settled back on just like a little makeup sponge, okay? Mm-hmm. And the way I would put that on, you know, on the back there. And I would basically use it for, you know, so the instrument didn't slide off my shoulder, you know? But I found that if I have a really nicely fitting chin rest, and of course I have the opportunity to make any one for myself, and sometimes I make one for a client and I say, wow, that's good. I should make one for myself, and I'd make one, and then the next client would come by and say, hey, that's really good, so I'd have to give them mine. So then I have to go make another one. And so I've been trying a whole bunch of different ones for myself over the years. And eventually, so this is the model that works for me, you know, which is very similar to one that I was just playing a few months ago. But I just happened to have this nice piece of wood from a tree that fell in my backyard. And I said, let me make something. I'm going to make it a little different. And I just modified it slightly, and it's very comfortable. But the other one was comfortable too. But so it, when if you have a proper fitting chin rest for the proper height and everything, you know, then you can just sit on your collarbone and the instrument doesn't slide off, you see? And I don't need to have anything here. I see like master classes where professors who maybe play without anything underneath, they say, take that chin rest, that shoulder rest away, take those pads off, you know? And I think, well, you know, I can play like that, you know, but don't tell a student like that to do it right away, because their chin rest is not good for it. You know, that's pain. They're not going to be able to do it, you know. So I think it's very irresponsible to say that without giving them the option, you know. So I say, you can take that away, but I'll give you the chin rest that's going to let you do that, okay? Because if it's not the right height, you know, you're going to be doing this. You're going to raise your shoulder, okay, which is maybe excessively. I say excessively because movement of the shoulder is like movement of any muscles. It's what's going to keep you flexible and going to keep the stress out. So when a teacher says, keep your shoulder down, and I say, no, move it, okay? Up or down, just as long as you move it. It doesn't have to even a lot, but your muscles need movement to keep fresh, okay? Yeah. Stiffness comes when you can't move something. This is one reason why I'm not in favor of the rigid shoulder rests, you know, whether it be a Kuhn or Wolf, it doesn't matter. They're all the function of a rigid rest is to establish a set distance between your shoulder and the instrument. Not everybody uses it like that, but most people will end up with that. But the problem is, you know, that here I have nothing. You see, and I am, and now I'm just going to go into the seventh position.
Yeah.
Okay. So my shoulder naturally wants to go up just by doing that. It's a natural motion when you go reach for something. Because your arm is not just your hand up to your shoulder. It's the extra part up to your neck, okay? The shoulder is actually not a fixed point. It's another joint in the whole system. So when you do this, your shoulder moves up. Now, if I have a rigid shoulder rest, something like this, and I move up into seven position, okay? I've reached seven position, but without the aid of the flexibility of my arm to want to do that, you see? So I've stopped my shoulder going where it wants to go, and stress and pain results, okay? The other problem with the shoulder rest is that I'm up here, and my shoulder's up, and I come back down, my shoulder wants to go down. But if I have a shoulder rest, which is relying on my shoulder to be clamped, and I then move in the lower position, and I release my shoulder, now the shoulder rest could slip off my shoulder. So I'm obliged to keep this tension even when I'm going down, which is should be a point of release, you see. So having a rigid shoulder rest solves some problems but creates a lot of other ones. And some, I've had people with thoracic outlet syndrome where the shoulder rest will be cutting off the circulation, you know, of the blood and the nerves, and they can't play anymore. So we have to give them something different, retrain them, and get them back out there. So I can play without anything, okay? Because I have a nice fitting chin rest, you know, and I like the idea of the flexibility. So you notice when I'm playing, you know, I can move the scroll up and down. This is vital for two reasons, at least, okay? One, okay, it keeps the whole thing moving, okay? So my muscles are always relaxed. I can play for hours like this, okay? The other thing is, part of my pedagogy is that when you produce a sound, and this has to do with the weight idea again, okay? Is that if you're going to apply weight, I have a demonstration that I do with people like this. I'll describe the demonstration. You're standing in front of somebody, and you press on their forehead as though to push them back, okay? And they're going to resist because they don't want to fall over, right? Okay, and I say, okay, let's say I pressed you with about 5 pounds pressure, assume, okay? Now I'm just going to put my finger on your forehead, okay? And now you're going to push back on my finger with the same amount of force that I just pushed on your forehead. And they do that, okay? So we had the same 5 pounds of force, let's say. I pushed them and they pushed back on my finger, okay? But it wasn't the same production. I pushed them with 5 pounds forced. And usually what happens, they resist, so they regain their balance. And they regain it by tightening their stomach muscles, okay, because that's a natural thing to do. When I ask them to press 5 pounds on my finger, they always push their head forward, okay? So this is my example, getting back to the weight business, okay? The head is the small muscle. The core, the stomach, is the large muscle, okay? So how, as an exercise, am I going to teach people, you know, so one's active, one's reactive. Mm-hmm. When I press them, they reacted using their stomach muscles, okay? That's a large muscle. That's a reactive muscle. But it was still 5 pounds of force that they applied. When I asked them to push, they use the small muscles of their head and neck, 5 pounds, right? So when I'm bowing, I put 5 pounds pressure. Where did that come from? So if I have the violin like some rigid here, like this, you can take my hand away, whatever, and I put the right hand and I press 5 pounds. I've got that, okay? But it's 5 pounds. Again, we just realized in the previous experiment, we have two different directions that I can come from, okay? What if I take the bow, put it on there, and then I push up with 5 pounds and just react here? Immediately the sound is different. I don't know if you could pick that up on the microphone, okay? So what happened was the same volume of sound, more or less, same 5 pounds, okay? But this time I lifted up with my left hand and I reacted, but not with my fingers. I did the same thing with the core of my muscles, my stomach. I reacted with the larger muscles in my body, right down to my stomach. So I feel the bow stroke, the force in my stomach, and my fingers are loose as anything. You see? This is the sound. So if my left hand is able to move and produce a sound, I have a much better chance of using the weight as a reactive force when my left side is free to apply the active force. If I can't do this, then I'm in trouble, okay? Most people, when you see them, a violinist, and when I watch quartets or chamber music or orchestra, you know, and you see them move, it's always from the waist. Why? Because they're locked in. Their head is locked into the instrument because they're pushing it into the shoulder rest, into their shoulder, okay? And if they're going to move and give a cue, it's always from the waist, okay? If you watch me or anybody who does my technique, this is the cue. The head stays straight and you go, boom. You just have to cue with the scroll. The rest of the body is like you're sitting and meditating type of thing, okay? That's the way to do it.
Yeah, so you're just going to show us the support you developed.
Like I said, the chin rest is only to make sure the instrument doesn't fly off the body.
Yeah.
And so what I did was, so here's a strap. It's it's about the 1-inch nylon type of thing with a loop, okay, with a barrel lock on the other side so you can adjust it. So this just goes on like that. Now, I've got this little thing, triangular piece of leather with a bit of Velcro with a specifically designed hook, okay, which you can put in different areas. Goes on the back of the instrument, simply like this.
Okay, I see that.
Okay, there we go. And then this string here will be hooked under there. You adjust the distance here.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Now you've got this hook. It's really secure.
Yeah.
So I don't even need a chin rest. Okay, it's for a Baroque instrument. It's great.
Yeah.
I can do whatever I want here. You know, and just comes off. And I'm wearing a shirt here, so but it's very easy to just put on and off. You see, so and it really liberates your left hand. You know, there's no stress at all in your neck because you're not pressing down anymore. You know, and it's my son Leo has been playing with for years now, and it's you know, it's just the best thing.
That's fascinating. Thanks for sharing that with us. That's really cool.
So that's my latest invention on the shoulder thing. I call it the Senza Rest.
So do you sell it through?
Yeah, not through anything. I mean, I sell individually. You know, so to people who want it. You know, like I say, I had other versions earlier with which were not as convenient. You know, for others, some elderly students. You know, like my 96-year-old student, he was kind of hunched over, and so he had no collarbone really. You know, so
yeah.
and the shoulder was out of position, so it was very problematic. But this really helped to secure the instrument. But the methods I had, and I mean, a loop isn't new. I read in the book, Heron Allen's book, 1837, whatever, that some Italian had come up with some sort of loop system. So mm-hmm. it's nothing new. And Baroque players, they play with some scarves wrapped around.
Yeah.
But most systems with these loops are a good idea, but it's the attachment is the problem. You know? And I seem to have solved the attachment problem with this little hooky thing, and it's adjustable, so you can move it around. So if you want your instrument to here or there, you know, this thing, just this little hook comes off,
yeah.
You know, and you can just put it where you need it to be. Also, because of the Velcro, I've taken my little pad and put a little Velcro mm-hmm. there, so I could just put that on there.
Okay.
So if I need to turn a page,
yeah,
I gotta temporarily hold it with my shoulder, and I don't want it slipping down.
Yeah.
You know? So that works fine, you know. So I'm totally free to do what I need to do, you know.
You still don't have a website, though, right? Just
you're right. I don't have a website.
Yeah.
I'd be inundated if I did. I do have my finally got a YouTube channel where I put up that one video, and I have another short video about the Senza rest, mm-hmm. which I call it a hook and loop. So I didn't put it up because hook and loop's not a good name. It sort of describes it, but hook and loop is also the name for Velcro. So it's in the States, I'm going to call it the Liberty Loop. So I'm just so busy. I just haven't got, you know, maybe once I get write my book and stuff like that, or get more time, finish my house renovations or something.
And that YouTube video is beautiful. It's beautifully done. Shows the... I really enjoyed that.
It was my son Leo who made mm-hmm. that video. And so that was a project for... He had to do like an interview thing with... And shoot some video. Mm-hmm. So we said, okay, why don't we do two things at once here? And then we played the music as well. So.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for showing that to us.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad. All right. When I turned 50 type of thing, midlife crisis for me was, you know what, I'm just going to change Boeings and Bach, you know? I'm not going to perform them anywhere, like, nobody's going to come after me, I haven't got money to buy a fancy red Porsche, you know, but a liberation type thing is to just let go of all the rules, you know, that have been holding you back, you know? And said, why not? You know, why can't I not change the Boeings? Why can't I not play this real up bow instead of down bow? I'm going to throw out a couple of slurs, you know. It's like the printed page is great for a record, but it's a launching pad, you know. Once you're up in the air, you know, it's up to you to make it what it is, you know. So that's really what it's about, you know. So I encourage everybody to just go out and have fun, you know, and that's the type of thing. There's just so many restrictions in our life, you know, from the time when we were born, you know, from our parents telling us, no, don't do that, you know, or let's go on, we haven't got time for that, you know. And it's sure, you end up maybe in an orchestra at some point, and it's not really as fulfilling as you thought it would be, you know, but the orchestra is a strange animal, especially for string players. It's, we're not soloists anymore. You have to subjugate your individual personality, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you have to have the competence of a soloist in order to understand what it is that you have to do. But you can't just go off on your own. You have to be with the ensemble. You know, if you're a first clarinet player or something like that and you have a solo, you can take a little time here and there, maybe, you know, as it fits and express yourself nicely. But if you're a section string player, you can't do that. You have to play with everybody else, even if you're better, quotation marks, you know, or more musical, you know. And that could be a frustration as a string player.
I'm guessing for you that was when you play in orchestras?
You know, I think my ego was large enough to be bothered by it, but at the same time, I always felt that I recognized the greater good, mm-hmm. you know, and at the same time, I recognized that I got to express my technical ability to be able to play as an ensemble player. You know, the important thing is how good are you really at being with everybody? Mm-hmm. How good are you at listening? Okay, because that's another thing. It's not important to play your part as brilliantly as possible. The important thing is to play with everybody as best as possible. And mm-hmm. that in itself is a virtuoso skill. So you have to basically say, I'm a virtuoso player. I can play as best as the best of them, but I'm now playing with other people. So I got to up my game now. I have to play with them and encourage them, maybe affect them, you know, in chamber music and stuff like that, you know. But in orchestra, it is more difficult. And yeah, sometimes if you think the performance is boring for you, you know, it might not be for the audience. So you can't say it, you know, they might have loved it. I mean, how many times I finished the performance and the audience member comes up and says, oh, that was so beautiful, you know, and I'm not going to say, lady, you had no idea what you're talking about. You know, so I say, thank you very much. I'm glad you enjoyed it, because truly, I'm glad that she enjoyed it. You know, I maybe didn't have such a great time with this lousy conductor or something like that, and we just sort of mailed it in, you know, and it was not that satisfying, and I'm going to go home and have a glass of wine and complain about it or something, you know, that this is not the way Beethoven should be played or something like that. But yeah, you have to at some point, either you quit the orchestra job or you have some other things on the side. You know, start doing recitals, you know, do some folk music, do something that satisfies you in a creative fashion, just to get that pressure off, you know. Some people are satisfied being what I call musical artisans, mm-hmm. you know. They're technical, they know exactly what to do, but they're really not that interested in exploring the creative boundaries, doing something weird, you know. And they're really happy sitting in orchestra and just doing their part.
You had talked before about archery and getting in the zone and meditation and motion. I'm curious, when you're doing your making, your chin rest and violins and so on, and you're in flow, is that similar to the type of flow you get into when you're improvising or playing in an improvisatory style?
No, when I'm making, I mean, there's a certain amount of, I have to, so when I have the client in front of me, and I'm as soon as they come in, I start getting shapes of chin rests mm-hmm. in my mind, and I do a lot of creative work in my mind. You know, I like to do a lot of mental work, imagery. Mm-hmm. So, like for instance, if I'm building a new shed out in the backyard, you know, I don't start with paper. I start in my mind. Mm-hmm. I draw it out in my mind, and I try to do as many measurements in my mind. It's kind of stupid, I guess, but I just like to be able to flip things in three dimensions around, and I say this is working around, and I measure it, I need 6 inches overhang. I try to keep all the images in my mind. So when the client comes, I start getting images of how they're playing, and then I image in my mind how their chin rest is affecting, because I can tell from the sound, you know, where the pressure points mm-hmm. are, you know, and then I say, take this one, and whenever I hand them a chin rest, I already know the shape of it, and I have an idea of what it's going to do to them, and I give it to them, and they play, and if it comes out exactly as the sound that I thought it was going to be, I say, okay, take this one off, and I just keep feeding them. They don't know what I'm doing, really. I keep giving them a different chin rest, and I get different sounds, you know, until finally it's I'm narrowing it down, and I say, okay, I see what you need, and sometimes I might make them like three chin rests, because I have to fine-tune it, mm-hmm. you know, so I might give them three different shapes. So that part is the creative part. Once I have the images in my mind, I get into my shop and I start carving, and I listen to podcasts while I'm doing that, you know. It's fun. But when I'm, you know, improvising, it's a different type of thing. One of my difficulties is following the form, harmonic mm-hmm. form of a tune. I can get lost easily, because suddenly I consider myself always a melodist, mm-hmm. you know. So if I'm going, I can go on and on, you know, for hours like that. But the thing is, I might play like 12 bars or 13 bars or 10 mm-hmm. bars, and I get lost harmonically, you know, where I am, you know, and because I'm just following the melodic mm-hmm. line in my brain, you know, and it can go on forever, you know. And I can just go from one thing to another, but I have difficulty reining myself in. You know, so yeah, when I play, sometimes I put backing tracks on just to mm-hmm. get myself locked in so I don't go off the rails You know, but a lot of time when I was young, I used to play etudes, and I used to make up my own etudes in an improvisation. So I would say, okay, I have to, I'm going to practice staccato, upo staccato today, you know, so I practice this, and after a while it's... I just go, just keep going. This, you know, I remember I wanted to, I was interested in staccato, and I asked Arthur Garamy, my teacher, you know, about staccato, and he gave me a short explanation. He said, here, take this etude and this piece. And the etude was like, you know, a short etude, and the piece had like 3 bars of staccato in it, you know. But he didn't tell me anything about pressure, nothing like that. He just said, take these and practice, you know. And it was very limiting. You know, so I had to go home, and I would look at, I'd start doing etudes, and I did them all upo staccato, downbo staccato. I just kept doing, I just put overlaid staccato on every single piece I could find, you know, and then I would just make stuff up, you know. And the same thing with double stops. You start with a third and a fourth and back to a third, and then you octave, and you just keep playing. Then a piece comes out, you know, and just it's fun like that, you know, so... Yeah, it's and then yeah, that's sort of like a zone, and if you can get into that zone, your practicing is a lot better, because then you're really focusing on what you want to focus, you know. Because if I'm playing an actual piece, you know, and I'm worried about getting a boom in time, that's one thing. But if I'm just playing my staccato and I realize that, oh, as I'm getting closer to the tip, it's a different technique than in the middle, and definitely different when I'm at the lower half of the bow. So, but if the piece I'm practicing is, you know, and if that's all I'm going to do and I keep doing it, it's going to take me a while to improve. Better that I just go... stay in the middle, and then after... do something at the frog, you know. But what am I going to do? I'm going to make it up, you know. So my practicing became very improvisatory that way, you know. I'd make an etude for whatever I wanted to work on, focus it, stay there, learn it, and then move on. So don't waste time.
Wow. Well, this has been an amazing conversation today. We'll have to have you back and talk about other things. There's so much to talk about.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, plenty. So I'll tell you how to ride a bicycle. Yeah, it's one of my favorite ones. Oh, how to teach your kids to ride a bicycle. That's also good, because you probably know how to ride a bicycle. But if you're teaching your kids how to ride a bicycle, that's...
Can you tell us in 2 minutes or less how to teach your kids to ride a bicycle?
It's one of my examples that I give when you're telling somebody a technique, which is imagery or not, for instance. So if you're going to tell somebody... you know, teaching somebody how to walk a tightrope. You say, "Well, get on the rope and stay on the rope and go." You know, you told them nothing. They're obviously going to stay. That the whole point is to stay on the rope. You know, if you're tightrope, but you've told them nothing. But a lot of violin teaching is like that. You know, put the bow on there and make a nice sound. Go. You know, you've told them nothing. So I use the imagery of the story of how to teach a kid to ride a bicycle. So a bicycle, you're on a bicycle. It has a certain gyroscopic effect to how you stay up. You know. And the bicycle can stay up by itself almost with nobody on it, riding down a hill. A bicycle will stay upright. But so you get the kid on the bicycle, and you're holding them behind, and you're pushing and say, okay, you get to the corner, you turn right. You know, they turn to right, and they fall over. So the thing about maintaining staying on a bicycle is a question of balance, okay? And the steering on a bicycle is designed in such a way that you steer in the direction that you're falling. Okay, so your steering, in a sense, is always avoiding a fall. You're always falling on a bicycle, but you have to steer in the direction of the fall to stay up, you see? So if you're teaching a kid how to ride a bicycle, you know, you first teach them stationary, and you lean them to the side, and you have them, let's say, left, and you have them turn the steering to the left so they straighten up. Then you lean them to the right, and you teach them this thing, how to stay up. Okay, why? Because... when you're going, okay, let's say you're going straight on the bike and you want to turn to the right. What do? Well, you turn the steering to the right, right? No, you're going to fall, okay? Because if you're going right and you turn to the right, you will fall to the left because your momentum is going straight and your wheel is now going to the right and you're going to fall, Okay. So what people don't realize, a subtle thing goes on when you're riding the bike is you're going and you want to turn to the right. So you pedal straight, and then you have to, because you're going to turn, and before we said that turning is balance for falling, right? You are going to lean to the right, okay? And then you're going to turn, and you're going to go to the right. But how do you lean to the right? Well, in order to fall to the right, you have to turn to the left. So you're going straight. You want to turn right. First thing you do is you turn a little bit to the left. You start falling to the right. Mm-hmm. Then you turn to the right, so make sure you don't fall. And that is your turn. This is what happens when you ride a bike. The initial left turn, you know, is so subtle, you know, that we're not conscious of it. Kids will pick it up. They'll eventually learn. This is wiggling around on the bike, and okay, and they're balanced, and they figure it out. We all figure it out. The same way that you can pick up a violin without lessons, you can figure it out. But if you want to go to the next level, you're going to need more lessons. You're going to need to know the facts, you know. It's like I spent a lot of time looking at how people walk, because I was helping some, you know, my mother and some other people, teaching them how to walk when they were after hip surgery, you know. So walking, you can say, okay, you stand and you take a step forward, and that's one visual about it, you know. Or you can say, taking steps and walking is preventing you from falling down. So in whichever direction you're falling, you put your foot there. When you watch a little kid who's learning how to walk, they're kind of unstable. They're going left and right, backwards and forwards. Okay, they're figuring it out on their own. But if you're teaching somebody who's older and doesn't understand it, you have to say, you're going to fall forward, you put your foot there. You're going to fall to the right, you put your foot there. So wherever you're falling, you put your foot. How do you start? You stand up straight. You lift your toes. As soon as you lift your toes, you're going to start falling forward. Then you put your foot out to stop yourself from falling. And wherever you're falling after that, you put your foot there. And you're walking. Hmm. So walking is basically us stopping ourselves from falling, which is a different approach, you see? But that's actually what's happening when you think about it. You can't walk unless you fall.
Yeah.
And the walking is stopping you from hitting the ground.
Well, I feel there's a philosophical book there somewhere you could write.
I'm supposed to be writing a book on the chin rest and the violin performance, but I haven't gotten around to it yet. It's way too... I should get around to it. It's been too long. Too many things. And you know, there's only 24 hours in a day, and 8 of those you got to be sleeping. So, you know, and once you have kids, you don't have that
time. Well, thanks for your time with us today. You know, it was really great.
A pleasure. And anytime, if I can come back and maybe we can narrow down the topic to something else. Kind of impossible, I think, but...
We can do that. It's not like the way we usually do things, but yeah, for sure.
Unless you want, we can just rattle on for another 2 hours next time as well.
Thanks.
Thank you.
My life is so enriched by getting to know these incredibly inspiring creative guests and their perspectives on their lives and music. Please follow this podcast and sign up for my podcast newsletter to get sneak peeks for upcoming guests and find out about newly published transcripts.